as we heard earlier, is about 100 million Americans who deal with chronic pain. And for a small group of those, opioids are kind of a last resort. Long term, they work, they relieve pain, give a quality of life, allow these people to go shopping, go to work, support themselves, you know, play with their kids, go on walks. Without the medication, their lives change drastically. In this hour, we're going to hear some of the impact on people after opioids are taken away from them. And get into a little bit more of the driving forces behind the crackdown. Our first guest coming up in just a moment, Dr. Josh Bloom, has worked inside the pharmaceutical industry as a researcher and now is with a public interest group that we're going to hear about in just a moment. Stick around. Coast to Coast AM, more to come. Welcome back. Dr. Josh Bloom earned a PhD in organic chemistry from the University of Virginia, followed by postdoctoral training at the University of Pennsylvania. He worked for more than two decades in the discovery of new drugs. He's the author of 25 patents, has 35 academic papers, gives a lot of invited lectures about how the pharmaceutical industry really works, currently with the American Council on Science and Health. Josh, welcome to the program.
Good morning, George.
I saw an article you wrote a year ago, November 2016, and the title was, Have Opioid Restrictions Made Things Better or Worse? From the vantage point of a year later, what do you say now?
You could see this coming about 4 years ago when I wrote my first op-ed on it for the New York Post. It was December in 2013. And at that time, there was a move to further restrict Vicodin, which is weaker than Percocet. Percocet was scheduled 2, which is the highest level of restriction. Vicodin's a little weaker, and they had it at 3, and it was so your doctor could call in prescriptions, et cetera. So that all started to go away, and I didn't like the way things were going right there. And it just seemed obvious that there was going to be a war on pain patients coming up. And 4 years later, we're seeing it, and it's worse than I ever imagined.
The kinds of stories that I hear, and we'll get into more of them later, but are just, they break your heart. And I'm sure you hear the same thing. I've been reading your stuff for a long time. It's helped me learn about these issues. And it's amazing that doctors, pharmacists, the industry in general could just turn these people away.
Yeah, they call me. I get 2 or 3 calls a week and a bunch of emails, and you know, I get them just because I write about medical issues and scientific issues, and I can usually be of some use to the people that call me or write in. And it's frustrating because I have nothing that I can tell these people that can help them whatsoever. And your typical person is somebody who's been on painkillers, let's for a crushed spine or some degenerative disease for 10 years, and they're taking him off or knocking his dose down. How am I going to get through this? And I have to say, I don't know. And I say the same thing to everybody that asks any question about this, is I don't know. And this really makes me furious. It's really a crime which is being committed for absolutely no reason, and it's making things worse, both for addicts and for patients. Aside from that, it's working fine.
Yeah. Big pharma, you know, of course, it's a convenient whipping boy. I've done it myself. I mean, nobody roots for big pharma, despite the great drug research that's been done and the lives that have been saved. On this point, the development of these powerful painkillers 15, 16 years ago, the picture that the public has is that the drug companies unleashed this on an unsuspecting public. Everybody got addicted, and that's why we're seeing so many people dying now. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, it's partially true. The opioid addiction really started with OxyContin, which is high dose oxycodone, and that was approved in 1996. And I think the theory behind it was good, in that if you, it's usually better, especially for a chronic condition, to take a drug which is slow release rather than immediate release and have to take it every 4 hours. You get more steady blood levels. So that was at least the science behind OxyContin. Take one a day, maybe there's going to be less a addiction, or certainly there'll be better pain control. So that isn't entirely wrong. And I think what happened, though, is, and this is just hearsay, is that it got abused by Purdue Pharma, who were the inventors of OxyContin, and they paid a whopping fine of more than $600 million for promoting the drug as safer than it really is. So there is some blame there. You know, there's no question about it. Some people should be in jail for what happened. But to blame the industry as a whole is a cop-out, and it's also a distraction from the real problem. Because whatever Purdue did 5, 10, 15 years ago, it's irrelevant now. Because the people are not dying from these pills, and they're really not getting addicted to them anymore either. So I have an objection when people raise the pharmaceutical industry as the bad boy here. And I have no particular bone to pick with them one way or the other. I was laid off by the industry in 2010, so it's not like I'm on defending them blindly or anything, and we're not making any money from them either at the American Council. So I just tell it like it is. And there was some blame, but I think it was only a very small part of what's going on today.
It's also true that these drugs helped millions of people. I mean, they changed their lives.
For sure. If you like irony, 5 or 6 hours ago, I needed a half of Vicodin for oral surgery. And I'm thinking, you know, wouldn't it be hysterical if I got on the show and was too stoned to talk about the science because of the Vicodin? But fortunately, it wore off and it wasn't all that bad. But yes, pain control is a big, big problem. And I've written that heroin and aspirin were both invented in the late 1890s. And what do we use now? We use heroin and aspirin in different forms. So the opiates are heroin, the NSAIDs are aspirin. So there's really hasn't been a whole lot of progress in 125 years. So it's just one of those unmet medical needs. So I get you come down to the choice, what's worse, living in terrible pain or drugs that aren't really wonderful? And the answer is you have to make people comfortable. It's more important, and that's more important than worrying about other people getting addicted to it. And this is where I really have a problem with the strategy that's going on in the United States today.
There was a 75-year-old woman I knew who was dying of cancer not too long ago. Her doctors are balking at giving her pain medication because they don't want her to become addicted, which has struck me as ridiculous.
Well, it's McCarthy time. I mean, I wasn't old enough to experience that, but I can imagine what it felt like. It was this unstoppable movement, which just has everybody scared to death. And I've talked to pain management doctors, I've interviewed them, and this is real. These guys are getting in trouble, and they're scared, and they're not going to write prescriptions for these pills for patients. Sometimes some of them are pain management specialists in particular, just getting out of the business entirely. Their job is to give opioids to patients because in most cases for severe pain, nothing else works.
We haven't really got into the discussing the CDC's role in this. I was going to do that probably in the next hour, at least concentrate
sure.
it there. But the Centers for Disease Control issued some guidelines in March of 2016. You wrote about it. One of the phrases I'm trying to remember, you quoted somebody in one of the articles you wrote that compared it to the language of an extortionist, what the CDC did. Do you think it was on purpose?
I can't read minds, but everything I've seen since then would lead me to believe that there's something that just doesn't smell right here. There's a lot of funny language, phony statistics, or twisted statistics, and half-truths that people who were involved with the CDC, and I'm talking about PROP, the Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing, I don't like the way they're reporting this because it's wrong. And the thing I really did most was just to dig into the studies and the statistics that they cite. And almost everything that they say, it's just incorrect. It's not supported by the evidence. It seems like trickery to me. I don't want to go any further than that.
You know, the effect has been CDC issues voluntary guidelines. I'm using air quotes around that. And
big air quotes.
A lot of people think that they know that they're going to be taken at their word, that states are going to go ahead and adopt it because they don't know a way out of this opioid thing. Politicians will jump on this. They love to be seen as drug warriors fighting down on an evil scourge of drug abuse, which, you know, how well that's worked over the years. And so it's been adopted in 17 or so states. It's in effect all in many other states where it's not a law, but it's in practicality, it is the law.
Yeah, it's almost irrelevant now because I think there are about 20 more states that are working on legislation. But basically every doctor in the country has got to be afraid who's writing prescriptions for opiates. So, some of the advocates I speak with now and then, they call it a war on pain patients, not a war on drugs. And of all the things that disturb me most, it's that they've picked the wrong target. Because and even physicians, you know, that I speak to, I have a lot of physician friends, they believe the old storyline, which is that OxyContin and Vicodin, all of the things were prescribed by the millions and millions and millions. People got hooked on them, and then they've moved on to heroin, and heroin turned into fentanyl. Well, that's nonsense, because addiction by pain patients who really need the medicine is rare. And depending on the studies you look at, somewhere between 0.2 and 10% usually comes in around 1, if I had to just take a guess. So if, assuming 1 is correct, for 100 patients, for 100 addiction cases of opioids, 99 of them started recreationally. So I don't understand why we're making any effort to cut back on prescriptions to people who weren't getting addicted in the first place.
Yeah, it's like, okay, Mexico just attacked us. Let's invade North Korea.
Pretty much, yeah. It's just insanity. I've been writing forever that the CDC was solving the wrong problem, but it's actually worse than that, because they're creating a worse problem for pain patients, but also for drug addicts, because once pills became scarce and OxyContin use really slowed down in 2010. I guess I should back up. Important. That's at that point, the company was able to come up with an abuse-resistant formula that you couldn't grind the pill up anymore and snort it or smoke it, and it just turned into a gum. So at that point, everybody just stopped using it, and you could see the heroin shoot up immediately as soon as that drug came out. So in fact, it was the scarcity of pills that caused the heroin surge. And then in 2014 or so, then fentanyl began to come into this country. And that's why people really started dying, because there's never been a drug like fentanyl before. It's nothing like we've ever seen.
Well, I know here in Nevada, it hasn't really hit. It's coming. I mean, it's here and there. It's arrived. But, you know, the prescription opioids have decreased in our state every year since 2011. And then after 2016, I don't even know what the numbers are. But heroin deaths have spiked, have gone up every year
since
then. Well,
that's not a coincidence. In fact, one of the pieces I wrote had statistics from across the United States, and I think from about 2010 on, the number of pill-related deaths, and I'd like to talk about that in a little more detail later, because that isn't what it seems either, they've held steady despite all the pressure that's been put on doctors and patients. But the number of overdose deaths has gone up since 2010, and it's all because of injectables. So how's that working out? Not so well.
You know, I can remember the same sort of argument being made about marijuana back when I was a kid, how it's a gateway drug, and if you smoke marijuana, it leads to heroin. I suspect that it's more related to the individual addictive personality than it is to the substance that you start on.
I would argue that the marijuana-heroin connection is stronger than the pain patient-heroin connection, because a certain number of people that smoke marijuana are going to go on to harder drugs, and it's not a subject I have these statistics about. But very, very few pain patients are ever going to. So that's the irony here, that taking these pills away from pain patients and taking them out of the general population where they've been sold by street dealers is actually making people die from fentanyl. And that's cause and effect. There's no question in my mind that, of course, it will never get done, but if you flooded the streets back with the pills again, people would live more. There would be fewer overdoses. Now, of course, that's ridiculous. It's never going to happen. But the killer here is fentanyl and some of its chemical cousins. Because these, you know, anything that makes heroin and morphine look weak, that's a monster. And these drugs are absolute monsters. And there's never been anything like this in the history of the earth before.
Do you have some solid numbers on the number for pain, for pill deaths? Because they're hard to come by.
Well, they're hard to come by. And I think they're disguised also. And, you know, one of my pieces, I exposed a lot of the lies that were coming out of the anti-opioid people. So the best I can tell is the number from all opioid deaths is about 30,000. So you're thinking, well, wait a minute. It just came out as 64,000 people died from overdoses. Well, that's a trick. That was 64,000 deaths from all types of drugs and all overdoses. So it could be aspirin, it could be Tylenol, blood thinners. So right away, when they throw the 64,000 number in, that's a big lie right there. So let's say it's about 30 is attributed to the pills. But you look more carefully, and then you see that about half that time, you're seeing other drugs involved, like Valium, benzodiazepines, and alcohol. So if you do the math and you throw out all of the cofactors that go along with the pills, my best guess is that it's about 5,000, maybe 10,000. People dying from Vicodin and Percocets every year, which is about the same number as people are dying in bicycle accidents. And this is what people are getting hysterical about, 5,000 deaths a year. That's an estimate, but it's a good estimate.
We heard Dr. Webster in the last segment talk about research. He's hoping that the big pharma comes up with some kind of an alternative to opioids. How, you've worked in the industry, how hopeful are you, and what does it mean for the people who need it now?
I'm not terribly hopeful. Keep in mind, I did not work in this area at all, so I haven't followed carefully what's going on, except just, you know, any more than any other journalist. I have no inside information about what's going on in pain research. I think it's a very difficult problem. Some diseases just don't yield to all the money in the world that you throw at them. And cancer, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, there's been enormous amounts of money spent on research and in some cases very little comes out of it. So you can't force science to work just because you fund it. It's a difficult problem, and you got 125 years of failures to come up with non-addicting strong pain pills. So I wish them all the best, and there may be things going on that we don't know about, but it would be a wonderful, it would be an incredible advance to really get a pain pill that didn't have all the side effects and deficiencies of the opioids and its alternatives.
Josh Bloom, thanks very much. We've got the links to your articles from the American Council on Science and Health, and I really appreciate the stuff that you've written over the years. Hope to have you back again.
Great. Thanks very much, George.
Thank you. Coming up in a moment, we'll talk to a pain patient and pain advocate who's been around the block on these issues and lived it personally. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Our country is awash in cheap, powerful, plentiful heroin, and worse, fentanyl, which Josh Bloom was just referring to, maybe 100 times more powerful than heroin, and people are dying from it. That's not the same as opioids that the doctor gives you. It's a major problem, but the crackdown on addicts has affected a much bigger population, 100 million people or so who deal with chronic pain. My next guest is a chronic pain patient and a chronic pain patient advocate. Her name is Barbie Engel. She had a dream life. She was coaching at a major university, had everything she wanted, and then pain took it all away. Her job, her money, her marriage, everything. In a moment, we'll hear how she pulled herself out of that and what advice she can give to other chronic pain patients who are barely hanging on. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Earlier this year here in Las Vegas, all the leading pain experts in the country gathered for what they call Pain Week, a symposium where they exchange ideas and research and hear lectures and things of that sort. The person who I first met there and who helped me navigate this world is my next guest, Barbie Engel, who has co-founded her own organization called the International Pain Foundation. She advocates on behalf of pain patients everywhere because she is not only talk the talk, but walk the walk. She knows what it's like. Barbie, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, George. I'm glad to be here and glad to be sharing my story.
So give us a capsule version of what happened to you, the kind of pain that you endured and your efforts to get relief.
Absolutely. The short version, for 20 years I've been living with chronic pain conditions, and it first started with endometriosis, but in 2002, I thought I had already reached the worst pain I could imagine with endometriosis, and I ended up developing an autoimmune disease called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, now known as central pain syndrome. It affects my entire body. Doctors didn't really know what to do, and I had team doctors. Like you said earlier, I was working at a university. I had my dream job. I was the head cheer and dance coach and had team doctors and trainers and best physical therapists, and they really said, at first the hospital, I was in an auto accident. The hospital said I would be better in 3 to 4 days. I had some whiplash and I would be fine. And after a couple of weeks, I wasn't doing well. And I went back to my doctor and he sent me to the chiropractor, and then they started physical therapy. And it ended up taking 43 doctors to get a proper diagnosis, which on average for patients with chronic diseases, that develop chronic diseases, it takes 5 to 7 doctors. And for me, it was way above average with 43 providers. I saw so many different providers because there was so many different aspects of my body, not just chronic pain, but I had a loss of proprioception, and I was falling a lot, and this burning fire pain that at the time I just said, I'm in pain, help me. Now I know to use adjectives to share what I was going through. I got overtreated, undertreated, mistreated, and finally after 43 doctors got a proper diagnosis, and it still took another 4 years to get a proper treatment. During that time, I ended up in a wheelchair, and like you said, I lost my life that I had built from childhood, my job, my marriage, my home. I ended up on food stamps and really lost everything and had to struggle, find my way back, learn to advocate for myself, and learn to teach other people how to advocate for themselves.
I guess unless people have gone through chronic pain at this kind of level, you just can't relate to it.
You can't relate to it. When I was coaching, some of my students, I called them my kids. I was coaching on the college level, and they would say, "Coach, I hurt my finger. I dislocated my finger," or even I remember one of my kids had migraines, chronic migraines, and she would come in to practice with sunglasses on, like, "You can't wear sunglasses to practice." And she didn't want to not be on the field and not be with the rest of her team. So she forced herself to come to practice, even in severe conditions, severe migraines. And she would come in and be like, "I just was at the hospital. They gave me a Toradol shot." And I'm like, "All right, get your shot, get back out here." And I didn't even give them the time of day until it happened to me. And I realized there's some pain that is very, very difficult, almost impossible to overcome. There's intractable pain that we just don't know about, we're not taught about, that until you experience it, you don't understand it.
RSD, you know, I wouldn't know what that is okay. until we started. Arachnoiditis, I wouldn't know what that is. And I think most people in the public, they figure end-stage cancer, that's as painful as it can get. But it's not, is it?
It's not. Actually, reflex sympathetic dystrophy, RSD for short, the easiest way to explain it is reflex is anything in your body that's automatic. Sympathetic is your nervous system. And it feels like somebody put lighter fluid on you and caught you on fire. Some people have it in one extremity, where it's regional. For me, it's full body from head to toe. And then dystrophy is loss of muscle and bone, which caused me to have dystonia and was why I was in a wheelchair for almost 7 years before I got the proper treatment that helped me get to walking again.
I mean, when you're that kind of a pain, mm-hmm. You can't think about anything else.
You do not think about anything else. I mean, you think moment to moment instead of, you know, what am I going to do next week? You don't know. You don't know if you can go to a family function or church or any activity that you want to do. You don't, I mean, even reading a book, concentrating. One of the things that I do when I do my presentations is have people in the audience that don't have chronic pain put a clothespin on their finger while I'm speaking and ask them to keep it on as long as they can to see how long they can pay attention to me and follow what I'm saying in my presentation. And most of them take it off within 5 minutes. Imagine if you couldn't take that clothespin off or if you had pain from head to toe that was so severe that you had trouble getting out of bed. And when you did, you were wheelchair bound.
You not only lived it, but you now hear it every day as an advocate for pain patients. People call you, they try to work through their issues with you. And so you hear their pain literally and figuratively.
Yes.
And I know that a lot of people just end it. They kill themselves, don't they?
I've actually, since 2012, I've lost at least two friends a month to suicide that have just decided that they're done. They don't want to do it anymore. And since the CDC guidelines went into effect, like firsthand, I have witnessed that patients have lost hope and, you know, they want to end their life. And there's times I didn't want to end my life, but there was times where I thought I was going to die from the pain. And if you have no option for treatment or doctors that are willing to help you get the treatment that your insurance company will provide you, then you just give up. That is what's happening, is patients are giving up. I mean, the treatments that I have that got me from wheelchair to walking, they're not covered by most insurance companies. They're not covered by my insurance companies. Infusion therapy and stem cell therapy, and I use the oral orthotic and massage therapy and mindfulness and posture apparel. I've used opioid therapies. I've also used NSAID therapies, which the NSAID therapies left me with internal bleeding. So NSAIDs aren't necessarily the best thing for chronic pain. That can cause a whole new set of challenges and problems, and it did for me.
When you have this kind of pain, of course, it's not just you that suffers. It's the entire family, everybody around you. You mentioned about you lost your marriage over. I can imagine the kind of strain it puts on it.
It absolutely affects every aspect in your life, financially, spiritually, physically, emotionally. It causes depression. And why wouldn't it? If you have a great life, you're living a life that you've built and put together for yourself, and all of a sudden you are struck by a disease that overwhelms you, and then secondary conditions develop out of that. I mean, I don't feel ill will towards my ex-husband. He literally couldn't take that I was in chronic pain. I was the breadwinner. I was the head coach at university. I own my own cheer and dance training company. And he didn't, his whole life changed as well as mine. And, you know, I do have a husband now, and I have built my life back. And my husband now is absolutely amazing. But he never knew me when I was fully able. He only met me after I was sick. So he didn't know what he was missing. And he still saw something great in me, even when I couldn't see something great in myself.
So you went to dozens of doctors. And I know when you and I talked before, you told me a lot of them just size you up as soon as you come in.
Oh, yeah.
I can imagine. These kind of cases
doctor,
are...
In particular, he was a neurologist, and he walked in and he said, I know what you're trying to do, and you're not going to get away with it. And he turned around and walked out. And then I ordered my medical records from this office visit, and he had a whole list of things that he says that he tested me for, and marked it all down as negative. And he never did the test that he had written in his medical records saying that he did. He just assumed that it was all in my head, which many of the providers thought it was all in my head, or they treated me for the one thing that was their specialty, and that was it. If they were a lung doctor, they only looked at my lungs. If they were a heart doctor, they only looked at my heart. And instead of looking at the big picture, and finally that 43rd doctor looked at all of my records, and at this point I have 8 3-inch binders of medical records of everything that I've been through with all the procedures that I've tried and the $35,000 of physical therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy. And
well, you can see how doctors would look at that, hear your story and go, this is too hard.
This is just too hard. And now their hands are tied even more because I used to get calls as an advocate. I would get calls before the CDC guidelines went into effect from patients who were calling to help get assistance with navigating their insurance companies and getting access to massage therapy and chiropractics and other treatments that their insurance companies just didn't want to cover, alternative treatments as we call them, which should be first-line treatments, less invasive treatments. But now we get calls from patients daily, emails and phone calls daily from patients who are not even able to get life-giving medications that they've been on them for years, stable with the exact same dose for years, not even able to get them anymore, and they just don't even know what to do. The types of calls that we're getting and the scared patients, that has increased, and it's no longer my insurance company won't cover alternative care. It's my doctor won't even prescribe me the care that I was able to receive for all these years that I've been on it. And they weren't an addict. They weren't doing anything wrong. They were following, many of the doctors were making them sign pain contracts. And we would say, don't worry, if you got a pain contract, you're doing the right things. We think that prescription monitoring programs are great, and every state has a prescription monitoring program except for Missouri. We legislate for these things, and we advocate for them because it was, for us, it was getting proper and timely access for patients. And since the CDC guidelines went into effect, insurance companies aren't covering any alternative treatments whatsoever. They're not, the doctors don't want to prescribe the opioid medication, and the patients are losing hope and feeling like they're losing the help. And the doctors that are still out there helping are being attacked by the DEA and state legislators and the whole opioid hysteria. And so it really has become a different issue and different challenges in the last 18 months.
Well, I as I said before, the addiction issue is real. There is a problem there, but there's that the picture that the public gets is so different. They don't hear about chronic pain patients, which is a much bigger population, and the agony that they're going through.
Right. There's about 2.5 million addicts in the United States. There's 100 million adult Americans and about 25 million children in the United States that are living with a chronic pain disease. There's over 150 different chronic pain diseases. So, and most of them are rare that aren't known of. And so not known of by the public, not known of by the media, but also not known of by many of the providers. And so when we do have providers that are willing and able to help, they're just getting their hands tied with the treatment options that are on the table. Now we're changing what we're advocating for, and we're advocating for open access, right to try, for patients, for protection for the providers that are willing to help us. We want to live, we want to be productive in society, and we want to have access to life-giving medications, whatever that is, between the provider and the patient. The treatments that work for me aren't necessarily right for the person next to me, and I don't take opioids every single day, but if I have a lactic acidosis flare, or I have kidney stones, or when my gallbladder died, I needed opioid therapy in addition to the treatments that I use on a daily basis that are not opioid-based to get through my day. And I, you know, I, along with millions of others, live moment to moment instead of a normal life like someone without chronic pain.
I don't think the general public understands what you mean by these contracts either. The kinds of hoops that pain patients have to go through.
Right. We're treated just as addicts. We're treated as drug seekers. And I've gone into the hospital and had ER doctors fight in front of me because they, you know, one wanted to help and the other one thought I was an addict. Yeah, they literally got in a yelling match in front of me to the point where hospital administration was called in. It really is affecting patients. Patients aren't wanting to go to the emergency rooms. They aren't wanting to go to pain management facilities where they're drug tested. And many of the drug tests are coming back with false positives, and the patient isn't even given a second choice to run a new drug test or do a hair analysis or whatever it is. You have to beg for it. You know, I encourage the prescription monitoring programs. I think that pain patients are okay with signing pain contracts. I don't think that it's necessary for pain patients to sign pain contracts, but it helps the providers be more willing to provide treatment options for their pain patients. And so therefore it gives us access to care. Therefore we're willing to jump through these hoops. At the same time, when you just take all of our options away with guidelines, not even rules or regulations, but guidelines, it really ties everybody's hands and takes away the patient's quality of life.
So we have like 2 minutes left. Tell me, who do you think benefits from this crackdown other than the drug cartels and the insurance companies, or is that pretty much it?
Well, I think the rehab centers. You know, they're getting additional patients. The medications for addiction, the people who, I don't know if you want us to name the medications for addiction, but there's medications specifically designed for addiction, just like there is medications specifically designed for pain patients. I have seen people try to blame the pharmaceutical companies, and maybe some of them didn't say what all of the side effects were, but read your packet inserts from your pharmaceuticals, from your pharmacies, that when you pick up this script, the information is there. But the people that are running the addiction clinics and the people who are creating the addiction medications are making money on the addict side as well.
Any advice for pain patients who are out there listening to this program? Any hope you can offer? Should they call you up?
They can call the International Pain Foundation. We do peer-to-peer mentoring. We help patients find providers that treat their conditions. And, I would say for hope, one of the things that we just recently started suggesting is for patients to report their doctors that are taking their medications away. You know, it's a new strategy, and we're just starting to talk about this, but report them for under treatment. You know, if the DEA is going to come in for over treatment, well, let's show them how many people are under treated. Let's show them how many people in pain have been had their medications reduced without supervision or totally taken away without supervision, throwing these patients who have been on these medications for sometimes years, 20 years, 15, 20 years, into withdrawal symptoms.
Barbie Engel, International Pain Foundation, thanks so much. Appreciate your advocacy, and I'm sure we're not finished with this issue, so maybe you and I can talk again.
I would love that. Thank you so much, George.
All right. Coming up next, we're going to get into discussion of how this began. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, which adopted these supposedly voluntary guidelines a year ago. It's had drastic effects all across the country for millions of chronic pain patients. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.